Welcome to Simple Living Works, episode 68. I'm Jerry Iverson. It's my pleasure to be your host with my guest, former elected public official, talk show host, and environmental activist, Ed Fallon of the Fallon Forum. Simple Living Works. Yes, voluntary simplicity is effective, satisfying, faithful, and comprehensive, but it also works. If you're new to this podcast and would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen clear to the end. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye at my cue after the interview. Ed has a fascinating biography, which you can read at the link in the show notes. He organized the Great March for Climate Action. That wasn't his first. In the late 1980s, Ed worked in the peace movement. He organized the Iowa stretch of the Great Peace March and founded the Des Moines Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. From 1993 to 2006, Ed served 14 years in the Iowa legislature, representing residents of downtown Des Moines, the surrounding neighborhoods, and the city's northeast side. Ed's focus as a lawmaker was to champion the needs of constituency groups treated unfairly by government or neglected by the majority of policymakers. In 2009, Ed began a career as a talk show host with the Fallon Forum, the fusion of politics and civility. It remains one of the few independent talk shows in Iowa and currently broadcasts on four radio stations, two in Iowa, one in New Orleans, Louisiana, and one in Fayetteville, Missouri, as well as on the internet and as a podcast. In 2013, Ed spearheaded the Great March for Climate Action, and in 2014 led 35 climate activists on a 3,000-mile trek from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. Ed was one of the five marchers to walk every step of the way. In March of 2015, Ed walked 400 miles along the length of the proposed Bakken oil pipeline. He now continues his work to advocate for the farmers and landowners he met during that walk and is vocal about the need to stop the proposed pipeline. In November 2015, Ed walked 200 miles from Normandy Beach to Paris in advance of the UN Climate Summit. He currently serves as the director of Bold Iowa, a part of Bold Alliance, a network of citizen action groups in rural states. Ed was raised Catholic, was a member of the Trinity United Methodist Church for 20 years, and considered himself staunchly ecumenical. Ed's spirituality continues to inspire and direct him in his work, and he is not hesitant to say that his life is committed to working for social justice, both within and outside the political process. Ed and I also talk a bit about the state of independent radio and TV talk shows. There are some simple living podcasts, such as The Minimalists and Smart and Simple, which I list in my weekly Simple Living Works blog and in a preview page on my website, but very few simple living shows on traditional radio. I link to those in the show notes and also point out a few duds. Although there are numerous radio shows about financial advice, such as popular Clark Howard and Dave Ramsey, who help people stay out of debt and get the most for their cash and not get scammed, they have an underlining but not overt emphasis on simple living. Dave Ramsey is overtly but not obnoxiously Christian. One distinction worth making is between commercial and non-commercial media. Commercial podcasts contain full-length 30- and 60-second commercials. Non-commercial podcasts, as with non-commercial radio and TV, such as PBS and NPR, have sponsors that get their names mentioned. Ed's radio show has sponsors, such as the Sierra Club, Physicians for Social Responsibility, and some local restaurants, all of which he mentions in passing. I've always been amused, even annoyed, by the bumper sticker, "Don't trust the liberal media." For one thing, there are very few truly liberal media. I tend to be cautious with commercial media, print, TV, radio, podcasts, because their selection of stories and guests and their approach to them, that is, their slant, can be influenced by their advertisers. In the interest of full disclosure, I served 18 years as a professional beggar for public radio. Ed and I talk a bit about mutual friend and fellow marcher Dave Zart. I link to his ruminations in the show notes. Also of interest is my earlier interview with Iowa State Representative Rob Hogue, who wrote America's Climate Century. See the link in the show notes. Senator Hogue is active with Iowa Climate Advocates and is currently running for the U.S. Senate.
Well, Ed, I'm just curious. You were in the legislature in Iowa, and you gave that up to become a talk show host. Tell us a little bit about that happened.
Well, I served for 14 years. I mean, 14 years is a long time to be a state legislator in what is essentially, you know, a citizen position. It's good to have some turnover. And I when I decided to get out, I decided to run for governor. I was hoping to, take what I'd learned and apply to that position. I guess, I did well, but I didn't win. So, after that, I also tried to run for Congress. That was an experience. That was an eye-opener at just how powerful the political establishment in Washington is and to what extent they'll get behind their chosen puppets, because that's really what it felt like. It felt like I just had every force inside the Beltway coming at me. But I gave that up to try to do more work on the outside, both as a climate activist and as a talk show host, and that's been going reasonably well for me.
Yes, indeed. Well, I want to get to the whole talk show scene a little bit later, but let's give the listeners a little bit of chronology here. My understanding is that you were instrumental in organizing the six-month March, Climate Action March across America, which went all the way from Los Angeles on foot and bike to Washington, D.C.
That was my idea, actually. In February of 2013, let me back up a little bit. After my campaign for governor, I went to a talk given by Bill McKibben in Ames at Iowa State University. And it was a great talk, very, very compelling. And afterwards, McKibben and I and a handful of students were having a nice, elegant meal of cornbread and chili. One thing I like about McKibben is he's really down to earth, very approachable. And he was, getting input from the students, what they were concerned about. And he asked me about my campaign for governor. And I started listing off the issues that I talked about in my campaign, campaign finance reform, hog confinement, water quality, criminal justice reform, climate change. And he stopped me and he said, "Hey, wait, climate change is not an issue." And I was kind of surprised, saying, you're the climate change guru. What do you mean climate change is not an issue? And he said, "It's not an issue. It's a crisis." And so that woke me up. I mean, I've been concerned about climate change for a while, but I realized, this is a crisis. And I started thinking about it more deeply and trying to find ways in which to prioritize it in my work. And I remember kind of suddenly envisioning it as in a metaphorical sense. I imagine myself coming home to my apartment and noticing that a leg on one of the chairs was broken and a picture had fallen off the wall and broken. And maybe there was another item in the house that clearly needed to be fixed and repaired. And then I would notice that the trash can was on fire. Three of those are issues. One of those is a crisis. And we have to stop regarding climate change as just another issue. We'll get around to it when we can. Really, we've got to put all those other issues aside. I mean, I'm passionate about a lot of things, but my call, my appeal to people is, what's the crisis? What really is going to upset the entire apple cart of our civilization if we don't wrestle with it? And then again, McKibben helped inspire me to make that shift. And once I did, I started looking for ways to make it a higher, priority where I wanted to figure out what I could do that would be the most impactful. And that's when I came up with the idea of a cross-country march. Originally I hoped that we could attract as many as 1,000 people. Well, that didn't happen. I just didn't get the kind of national backing that I'd hoped. But we did have 1,500 people show up at the kickoff rally in Los Angeles. And we had 100 people march that first day. And then a core of between 35 and 55 people the entire way. And it was actually 8 months. It was, we left on March 1st from Los Angeles and arrived in Washington, D.C. on November 1st. And I've always believed that if you challenge people to do something big, whether you're a union leader who says, hey, we got to go on strike, or whether maybe you're encouraging people to fast for a just cause. In my case, I'm encouraging people to walk all the way across the country. I felt that an obligation to do that myself, to set that example. And also because we wanted it to maybe be clear that climate change is a crisis, and we're all going to have to step forward in a huge way to address it. We're going to have to make sacrifices. We're going to have to expect this to be a challenge. And so it was important to embody that sense of sacrifice and commitment through the march that we all will need to embrace. So to me, it became important to walk every step of the way, and I did that, not without great difficulty or or some major obstacles, including losing 24 pounds. And if you know me, I'm pretty skinny already. I didn't need to lose 24 pounds.
It was grueling to walk that, 15, 16 miles every day, 6 days a week, 8 months, through all sorts of conditions. And I was kind of fortunate in terms of not having any injuries until Nebraska, about halfway across. I came down with plantar fasciitis, and it hurt. I went to the doctor and said, what do I do? And he said, well, you're going to rest. And so I kind of laughed. I said, well, that's not one of my options, I'm afraid. So I kept walking, and I kept finding ways of trying to push through it. And it got really, really bad just outside of Cleveland, Ohio. I remember coming into our camp that night, and our camp that night was we were in a church because we were in the suburbs, and there weren't a lot of outdoor tenting areas. So they put us up in a church, and I remember coming in and just hobbling from from my sleeping space over to the place for the dining room, and I was just terrible. And then I got up the next morning and I felt no better, and I tried to figure out if I could walk with crutches, because we have a marcher, a young guy, who had fractured his toe in Arizona, and he was grim and determined to keep going. So he learned how to walk with crutches, and he basically went all the way from Arizona to D.C. without missing a step using crutches. Amazing accomplishment. His upper body got as much or more of a workout than his legs. So I tried to use crutches, and I couldn't make it work. So I had to figure out a way to walk, to ease the pain of the plantar fasciitis and still keep going. What I did was I ended up using my walking stick. I've been using it all along, but I used it even more, and I basically, it almost became like a crutch where I put so much effort onto that stick that it, my arms absorbed the blows instead of my leg. And I would try to walk on grass and soft surfaces as much as possible. I would stop every hour to massage my feet. I found it helped to take smaller steps. And that was a 21-mile day coming into Cleveland. And I started early, and I finished hours and hours after the other marchers. I got in to our campsite at 9 o'clock at night. And I guess I didn't even know it, but I was all on my own at that point. And I remember I think I walked through the most dangerous neighborhood in Cleveland without even being aware of it. Maybe that was better than knowing it. But the next day I had a day off. We had a rest day, and that somehow enabled me to feel a little bit better, and was able to keep going. But that was a huge problem, was the plantar fasciitis. I basically walked 1,500 miles with it, which I don't know how. And other people on the march too. I mean, the guy walking with crutches from Arizona every step of the way, a woman who was 72 years old who walked every step of the way. There was another gal who, she lost 40 pounds walking. it was a huge, the sacrifices that were made were, beyond what any of us would consider making normally. But again, it was an important statement to make. We accomplished an awful lot of outreach. I mean, I can't even tell you how many people we spoke with along the way, but, you know, between direct conversations and people we reached through stories in the newspapers, on TV, we had a lot of press coverage. So, you know, I it was a good thing to do. It's hard to measure what the impact was because you throw those stones into a pond and there are ripples and you don't really know how far they go and who they reach, but it certainly seemed like we had a lot of contact with a lot of people and a lot of folks who wouldn't normally be on board with climate action, but you know, they through meeting us and hearing about our commitment, and also seeing we had a solar collector that we took with us, so we used that to charge our solar powered refrigerator. We used it to charge occasionally the cook would use a blender, and we had a coffee maker as well. We had a small wind turbine we took with us. We had, and actually the small wind turbine was from up northwest Iowa. Rob Hawk with anemometry specialist and lent that to us for the trip. And we also had a solar oven, or a couple solar ovens, and a parabolic solar cooker. We had a composting toilet as well. So these things were of interest to people. They'd come and they'd see our camp and they'd you know, be intrigued by how we made this work. And it would generate a conversation that would never have happened otherwise. You know, if I drove into a small town in Colorado and said, hey, I'm concerned about climate change, you know, ho-hum, big deal. But, you know, you walk here? when someone asks, you know, what you're doing, and they notice your gear and your well-tanned features and your walking stick, and what are you doing? And then the conversation starts, and they say, well, you must be, if you're walking across the country, well, gosh, it must be pretty important for you, it costs for you to want to do that. Yeah. And then the conversation starts. So, you know, how do you measure the success of something like that? It's impossible. All I know is that it felt like a really important thing to do. For me, it's probably the most difficult thing I've ever done. And I also think it had, you know, great impact. We can't measure it, but again, I just know how these things work out over time. And I'm fully confident that we made an important contribution to the movement toward getting realistic and taking action on the climate crisis.
Well, we have a mutual friend, David Zart, who was one of your oldest members of your marching team, and he would send us journal entries several times a week by email. And I know this march had a profound effect on him personally, but not just individually, but also in the interaction with the various age groups that were involved with the marchers. Do you have any brief conclusions about how the march affected you, besides your foot?
David Zart was our oldest marcher. And also one of our best-tempered marchers. He had a great disposition. He was never angry at anyone or always helpful. He was actually the one who took on the role of putting up and taking down the solar charger every day. Among other things, he would also he would walk sometimes, but more often he would hop on a bicycle. We had a few bicycles, and it seemed entirely appropriate that the oldest marcher would be moving from camp to camp on a bike. And just always helpful. And I remember a funny story with David. I mean, there were always conflicts, and we had one morning the woman who was cooking was kind of a control freak. She tried to manage everything to the T, and David was in the breakfast line in front of me, and the cook was saying, only take French toast or, what else did we have that morning? Granola or oatmeal, I can't remember. And he had both on his plate, and she criticized him for it, and he just kind of ignored her and walked away. And I went and sat down, and I said, David, you're breaking the chef's rules. And he said, well, you're confused, he says to me. You think that she manages my life, but she doesn't. I'm just going to do what I have to do. And then he went on to say that, you know, we just passed a federal prison the day before. He said, we should have left her there. He was joking, of course, but he had a great sense of humor. And you know, if he was going to be pushed around, he would just quietly smile and do what he felt he had to do.
Well, David was very active here in Sioux City with the Sierra Club before he and his spouse moved into co-housing in Carson City, Nevada, which is the capital of Nevada. And so he has become a peace activist in Carson City. No small task. But now I understand that you, your talk show is, I think, 1 hour a week, and that you continued doing that show even while you were on the road.
That was really hard. It was, well, you know, on the road, I was doing it. Back then, I was doing it 4 times a week for a half hour each day. And it was tough because I'd never know where I was going to land. I didn't know whether I'd have good service or not. I didn't know, you know, I mean, I was broadcasting from behind rocks, under a cactus, in little cafes, in the cabs of trucks. it was really hard. I mean, there were days when I was just right up against the wire where, boom, I'd suddenly find the place where I was able to do it a couple minutes before the show started. So, that wasn't easy. and I found some pretty interesting guests, people along the way that would come and be on my show.
Well, that's quite remarkable. Let's move on to your next hike, which I understand was marching to Paris for the climate conference. Tell us about that.
The next one was actually walking across Iowa after I came back from the climate march. I kind of spent the winter recovering. And recovery was not just physical, it was financial as well. I'd been dug myself a pretty deep hole there. And then when I learned about this pipeline, I wanted to do whatever I could to stop it. So I walked from the southeastern corner of Iowa in Lee County, following the course of the proposed pipeline up to Lyon County. And that was about 400 miles. And I felt that that was a good experience at trying to connect landowners. I met landowners in even adjacent counties who didn't know about the work that others were doing. And so that was pretty pretty important, I think, to be able to find that opportunity to make those connections. And, last fall, in response to the United Nations Climate Summit in Paris, me and one of the other guys who did every step of the way on the climate march felt it would be important to walk from Normandy Beach to Paris with the message that back in the 1940s, the U.S. did, we as a country rallied together, both as individuals and collectively, to respond to the threat of fascism. We did an amazing thing. We entirely retooled our economy in just a matter of, in less than a year, to be able to fight that war and to, who knows where Hitler would have ended up if we hadn't gotten involved. And, I say that as somebody who's been a long-time peace activist, but not seeing any other way that you could have addressed the spread of fascism. But the bottom line is, however you feel about the war, we did something incredible with our economy. We made a decision to totally rebuild it, to respond to a crisis. And this crisis we're facing right now, it's of a very different nature, but it's perhaps even more damaging over the long haul. But we need the same kind of universal commitment, that willingness to sacrifice, that willingness to do what needs to be done economically, individually, to fight this new fight. And that was the message we brought with us from Normandy Beach to Paris. And, that was a shorter walk, easier in some ways, hard in other ways. I mean, I do speak some French, but there was still a language barrier. It's not as easy as traveling through your own country, but it felt like a good thing, an important thing to do, and felt like we had an impact.
Well, that's indeed inspiring to me personally, Ed. And do you have any other march, any other plans in the works for the year, next coming year or so?
No, it's not. Again, to me, marching is not something I do for its own sake. It's something that that seems to be the right tools at the right time. And you know, I think elections are very important. I think it's very important that we help people who are going to do the right thing run for office and get elected. I think it's really important that we use every forum possible for education, whether it's a talk show or a speech before a Kiwanis Club or and getting involved with educational programs in the schools. Every venue, every opportunity we need to take. And to me, marching is just one possibility, but it's one I found out I'm pretty good at, at least for now, and enjoy, but it's also really, really difficult. It's not easy at all. So right now I'm happy just to be more hunkered down in Iowa and continuing to work on trying to stop a pipeline and to hold fossil fuel companies accountable.
Well, I enjoy listening to the Fallon Forum primarily by podcast. So your Fallon Forum, which is called The Fusion of Politics and Civility, I just love that, The Fusion of Politics and Civility, has gone through several permutations. If I remember correctly, when you started off, you were sort of the lone progressive voice on a conservative talk station, and then you went strictly internet, and now you're back podcasting and also on a Spanish music station, rebroadcast another station, Central Iowa, and then on a station out of New Orleans.
Yeah, I'm about to be on one in Missouri too. So
it's interesting because your show is a mix of there's arts interviews and of course there's politics and so many issues, but the focus is clearly on Iowa, and it's intriguing to me that people in New Orleans would be listening.
Well, we try to do segments that are relevant to that audience as well. I mean, during the caucuses, the caucuses were of interest to people across the country, and of course, Louisiana had one of their own running, Bobby Jindal, so we would talk about him. We also will be talking about water quality issues and efforts to control nitrogen runoff, soil runoff. That's a big issue to folks down in Louisiana as well. And there's always
Why is that an interest to them?
Well, because they've got the dead zone in the Gulf that's become a real economic problem for them, economic and environmental problem. And
what's that connection with Iowa? What's their connection with Iowa?
Well, of course, we're upstream from the Gulf of Mexico, and the soil runoff, the nutrient runoff into the Mississippi River and its tributaries is a big part of why that dead zone exists. And I think we know that. I think it's a challenge to figure out what to do about it. And I'm glad to see the legislature this session is making some efforts on that front. We'll see where it goes. I know it's become a very contentious issue because of the lawsuit filed by the Des Moines Water Works, and you could argue that a lawsuit's not the best way to go, but you can't argue with the fact that it has generated more conversation than would have happened otherwise. And so hopefully that'll lead to something, valuable. And that's of interest to folks down in New Orleans because, again, they're very impacted by what's happening in the Gulf.
Well, I'd like to talk for a few minutes, Ed, about progressive talk radio, because it just seems like there aren't a lot of people like yourself who are willing to be out there taking a progressive point of view. It seems like there's just a great clutter of conservative talk radio shows around the country. I listen, for example, occasionally by satellite TV or on the internet to Tom Hartman. And, it seems to me the biggest difference is that there are commercial channels. And granted, you do have sponsors. Tom Hartman has sponsors, but that's much different than commercial networks that are running public affairs programs. do you see any development? I mean, for example, when Al Gore sold his TV channel to Al Jazeera America, which is a terrific news source, but now it's going dark. And RT America, which is a terrific news, a source of news. And Tom Hartman has his the big picture on RT, which, by the way, stands for Russia Today. I just have very mixed feelings about the future for progressive news programs on radio and TV. What is your assessment?
Well, it's a challenge because there's been such consolidation within the various types of media. You certainly see it in newspapers. You see it in TV. But nowhere is it more prominent than in radio. And a lot of that traces back, ironically, to the Bill Clinton administration with the Telecommunications Act that allowed one corporation to own more than one FM and one AM station in any given market. So you had Clear Channel buying up all the big signals and buying up multiple signals. And, of course, you had Citadel and Cumulus also, two other big players. And now those two are merged. And actually, that's why I got bumped off the station I was on. Actually, there were two moderate or progressive voices on that station. And when when Cumulus took it over from Citadel, they threw us off promptly. So the problem is you've got a structure too with different rules for different types of radio signals. You've got the commercial stations, and those are all the big ones, and those are all owned by big right-wing corporations. Ironically, Bill Clinton, responsible for the Telecommunications Act, is one of the most frequent, now him and Hillary, of course, are one of the most frequent targets of their rhetoric. So the problem is you've got stations that have no interest in balance and no requirements to have balance. And they can say anything they want. Sean Hannity can call his show the Stop Obama Express. Now, on a community-owned station, you can't even say, you could never say Stop Obama. That would be against the FCC rules. And you can't have advertising. You can have underwriting, but it's a much more scaled-down type of sponsorship. It's less appealing to some businesses and others that might want to promote what they're offering. So you've got this incredibly imbalanced structure that absolutely favors the right-wing diatribe. It's not even that. There's a legitimate conservative voice that in this country, but what has grown to be the dominant voice on talk radio is not that at all. It's very extreme. It's nothing at all like what used to be considered a reasonable conservative viewpoint. But do you expect to find moderate or liberal voices in that mix at all? Not at all. Not out of 24 hours, not even a minute, And then you've got public radio, which again is much more balanced. I certainly wouldn't call it, liberal, but it's much more balanced. And it's really now a misnomer. Public radio used to be publicly funded, but around the same time that Bill Clinton was wreaking havoc on the broader radio universe, Newt Gingrich was defunding public radio, public TV. And, of course, there is still some public money involved, but a lot of it's from listeners and a lot of it's from sponsors. I mean, you can listen to a show on public radio and hear the tagline, underwriting provided by ADM, supermarket to the world, or by Walmart, you got a question when you've got a program, when you've got a station who gets a bunch of money from those interests, are you going to hear programs that are critical of, for example, the consolidation with agriculture or Walmart's impact on, small town retail? Are you going to hear programs that really criticize those things when you've got so much money coming in from those sources? So that's the problem. I mean, of all the types of media out there, radio is the most consolidated, the least friendly to balance, diversity, and any kind of a progressive message. And that's why I think it's so important to have internet options. I mean, I'm on smaller stations. I've got four small stations. But, like you said, a lot of my audience is online. And I think that's one reason it's so important that we preserve net neutrality, because without that, we wouldn't even have what we have now for balance and opportunity for people to hear other perspectives on critical news stories.
Thank you so much, Ed. This has been really insightful, and I just say, hang in there, buddy. You're doing a great job.
Thanks. You too, Gerald. Appreciate it.
Talk to you again, I hope. Be well. Bye-bye.
Right. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to my conversation with former elected public official, talk show host, and environmental activist Ed Fallon of the Fallon Forum. You're welcome to share your thoughts on these subjects. Email a message to simplelivingworks@yahoo.com or on my Facebook page or on the Simple Living Works blog. Those addresses are given in the show notes at our website, simplelivingworks.org. Click window number 3. Some very interesting response recently. If you search the internet for Simple Living Radio, Simple Living Works takes a top slot on Stitcher, the most popular app for podcasts on mobile devices. Received a note from Pinpenny saying, "Hi, I was looking for some information on Simple Living this morning when I came across your resource page. What a fantastic list of resources. I actually just published something on Simple Living called 16 Actions to Take Today to Live a Simpler Life. It might be a good fit for your page. Either way, keep up the awesome work. Thanks, the folks at Pinpenny." Also, in regard to my podcast with Peter Sautel of Echo Justice Ministries, the Northwest Iowa Sierra Group shared my post and said, "Peter Sautel covers a lot of ground during this episode from Simple Living Works." Also, in regard to that podcast, Kathy Jo Mitchell of the Progressive Christian Alliance, a Facebook page or Facebook group, said, "I had the privilege of knowing Peter when I lived in Denver. He's one of the kindest and most genuine people I have ever met. Thank you for sharing this." And I sent my birthday greetings to Jerry Torme, and he said, which are called helpful birthday ideas from Simple Living Works, and he responded, "Thanks for the wishes and good advice, Gerald. The older I get, the more simply I like it." I plan to start a new service in May called Our Simple Living Daily Nudge. It's a quote from one of the 1,000 articles, that's 1,000 plus articles, on the Simple Living Works site. Each entry will be indexed, so if you miss a day, you can catch up. Our daily nudge reminds us that simple living is more than my or your personal happiness or success. Instead, it's about our mutual happiness, our community. Most of the line art for the daily nudge will be drawings, or retro in style, on purpose. It's meant to highlight the text, that is, the words. While my weekly digest or blog is quite dense, some would call it text-heavy, containing some 50 links, the Daily Nudge is designed to have one quote, one idea, and one link. Subscriptions are free on Twitter and LinkedIn. Occasional entries will be made on Pinterest, Instagram, and Facebook. So if you're not already following me on those social media, please sign up right away. All the links are given in the show notes. Well, it's time to wrap up this episode of Simple Living Works podcast. If you're new to Simple Living Works and would like more information about us, please listen a little longer. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye here. Peace. If you haven't subscribed yet, we hope you will now through iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Remember that you can listen to all episodes of Simple Living Works podcast. They're archived twice. Access them at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. Click Preview, Backup, and choose the episodes you want with or without show notes. Subscription to this podcast and our weekly blog are free, and they keep you current automatically when we post something new. Urge your friends to do the same. Remember to like us on Facebook. You can also subscribe in iTunes to my other podcast, The Common Good Podcast, which I produce and co-host with Jubilee One Earth Economics. We do not solicit or accept donations, nor do we sell anything. All our services and resources are free of charge. We're an all-volunteer organization. Send us your email address to receive the monthly free Simple Living Works e-news. Thanks to the band Earth Mama and to John Pitney for the music on our show.
This podcast is covered by the Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution Share Alike license. To learn more about Creative Commons, click on its link on our website homepage. We at Simple Living Works believe that simple living really does work. Voluntary simplicity, choosing to live simpler lives, is a faithful, satisfying, effective, comprehensive lifestyle. It's not a list of rules, nor living on the cheap. It avoids fads, convenience, and deprivation. It's so much more than a hobby. We believe in abundance, that there's enough for everybody's needs, not anybody's greed. We follow the saying, live simply that others may simply live, as our closing theme song proclaims. Voluntary simplicity is a balance of personal responsibility and advocacy for just public policy. It's more than personal happiness, though that's quite important. Contemporary faith-based simple living is guided by the five life standards of Living More with Less, the classic by Doris Jansen Longacre, and I've discussed those standards in earlier episodes. The mission of Simple Living Works is equipping people of faith to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. We extend the mission and resources of the nonprofit organization Alternatives, which served from 1973 to 2011. The three parts of our mission are elaborated in text and video. Links are listed in the show notes. We produce a half-hour podcast twice a month, hopefully educational and inspiring for you, your family, and your congregation or group. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works podcast, wishing you well as we strive to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. Simply so others can simply live, learn to live simply so others can simply live, learn to live simply so others can live.